First Timothy chapter 2 is where we are.
Here, I'll take a drink.
First Timothy chapter 2, and we're finishing up our discussion of verses 9 and 10 concerning women's dress that the Apostle Paul talks about in that text. And I spent a bit of time last week, about the last third of the class, discussing this particular text of Scripture. I'd like to note again verses 9 and 10, read them with me in 1 Timothy chapter 2. In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now this is a part of a greater discussion of the woman's responsibility in the church, beginning there in verse 8 and going all the way through verse 15. We'll talk about the remainder of that in just a few moments' time. And you may remember that in our discussion, we kind of enlarged upon the concept of proper dress to be inclusive of men. I simply wanted to do that to acknowledge the fact that there are certain responsibilities that men have as well. There is a special appeal that is made to women. And one of the reasons that I would assert that is the case is because of the differences in men and women. I remember a number of years ago, Brother Harry Osborne brought a lesson on modesty. And he had in that lesson a survey that had been taken about the reason why people go to the beach. And in this survey, reasons were offered and allowed. And by far the largest reason given by men for going to the beach is to look at the women. And in contrast to that, the reason that was given by the majority of the women, I don't think the percentage is quite as high, but the majority of the women was to be seen. Now, I don't know exactly what that says about our society, but I think it is indicative of what we see typically with regard to fashion in general, and the idea that, especially with regard to women, with regard to the, well, we could use the description that is given here in verse 10, or latter part of verse 9, the braided hair, gold, pearls, and costly clothing, in addition to the idea of immodest dress. Immodest dress, what we mean by that, typically is dress that is sensual, dress that is too revealing, and as such inappropriate. But in this particular case, that word modest there has reference to orderly. So while we talk about the importance of modest dress as being that it must not be lewd or lascivious, it must not reveal too much, be too sensual, the fact is that the specific problem with dress that he is referring to here in this particular text is a bit different. It could certainly be inclusive of that, but it is dressing to be seen. And of course, the contrast to that is having a proper interior beauty. Notice in verse 10 of the text, that which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. So the proper dress is something that is not necessarily unattractive, but at the same time, it's not drawing attention to oneself so that you will be seen. When the Pharisees did that, they were excoriated by Jesus as being hypocrites and having their reward. When individuals come to worship or they dress, and their dress is a beacon, look at me, whatever it is that I offer physically is what is I'm interested in showing, that that's inappropriate. Now, again, that certainly will be the case with men as well. But the problem societally and culturally, and it has been from the beginning, is that is especially problematic and with regard to the women. So there is specific exhortation given to the women in this particular case. So dressing ostentatiously would be a violation of this passage of Scripture. Dressing irreverently would violate what is found in this particular passage as well. And so it would be inclusive both of men and women in the sense that we both have responsibilities, but this particular context is especially concerned with the dress of women, how they are to conduct and comport themselves as women. So we did talk about that, though again, we enlarged upon it. We talked about dressing irreverently in worship. We also talked, you'll remember last week, about the fact that our society is becoming more casual and the norms have changed, and it is a fact that people dress differently than they used to. And we as Christians, it seems, are always on the backside of those movements, those changes, which I think is as it should be and appropriate. But there are a couple of ways in which we need to be careful when we talk about the importance of modest dress and appropriate dress, that we do not press our own biases with regard to what constitutes that. It differs depending on culture. There are cultures where wearing a tie is not something that is practiced, or even wearing a coat. And, for example, in the Philippines, they dress far differently. In India, they dress far differently in other places. And in fact, there are different kinds of dress between urban areas in America and rural areas in America. There are different kinds of dress that are considered appropriate depending upon generational differences. One of the things that just drives me crazy is to see someone wearing blue jeans and a jacket and a tie with a shirt untucked. But that's something that's fairly typical among younger men. It's a kind of a casual, dressy look. And there's actually a new company, I forget now the name of it, Untuckit, I think is the name of the company, that create shirts to where they're not quite as long, so they don't look quite as sloppy when they're untucked. And so you show them wearing a jeans or maybe khakis and a coat and a tie, and their shirt's untucked. And it just looks so bizarre to me to see that. But it's something that is considered acceptable and even dressy in our society. So our biases that we might have, especially generationally, if we look at younger people, we think those people, they're not being reverent, they're not being considerate. It very well may be that they are, but it's a different style, a different way of looking at it. We need to be careful not to depress our biases. But at the same time, as we contemplate these things, we also need to recognize that we can be a distraction and we can lose influence if we dress in certain ways, and as Christians need to be mindful of that. What I'm basically saying is we need to be a little bit more understanding and tolerant in those areas, but that within that tolerance and with that understanding, there are limitations, and the limitations have to do with reverence and propriety and moderation. And those are the things that are required with regard to our dress. That and the old-fashioned term that we would use of modesty, that is something that is not lewd or lascivious. So those are the things to consider. But I kind of talked about that, and I understood at the very end of our time together that some might have some questions or some comments that they want to add to this. And so I didn't want to leave this section before we talked about it in full and entertained any questions that you might have or comments. So does anyone want to add anything to what we talked about last week and what I recapped just now? Yes, Chris. Yeah, I'll repeat her question. What Chris is asking is, where is the line drawn between a desire to look pretty and to be dressing in such a way as to be accepting attention or seeking attention that is inappropriate, as is found in this particular text? And in a way, I want to defer, and we've talked about this actually last week a little bit privately, and I want to defer somewhat to the ladies of the congregation in this regard, because I'm definitely not a fashionista, especially when it comes to the women. But a couple of things to note. I don't think there's anything in this that indicates it's inappropriate to be attractive. There's no prohibition, absolute prohibition against the use of makeup, for example, or jewelry. The idea is a matter of priority. So when we talk about that, the idea that some have is, as they walk out the door, I'm going to dress in a way to show off. And the showing off may be to present yourself as affluent. That is, look at me, I've got more money than everybody else, and you can tell by what I'm wearing. It could be that you're presenting yourself as sexually attractive and dressing for that particular purpose, or simply you want to be the center of attention, and so you dress appropriately. So it could have to do with the whatever you're wearing, the way you style your hair. It could have reference to the colors of the clothes, all those kinds of things. And we see people who show off with their dress all the time in the world. It's something that's very, very typical. And as Christians, we have to be careful not to cross that line. Now, as that line, what that line is, it's one of those things. Remember, I don't remember where it was on the Supreme Court when they talked about the difficulties, because obscenity is not protected speech. The difficulty in saying what is, or defining what is obscene. And I don't remember if it was a justice on the Supreme Court or someone else who said it, but it's a fairly commonly heard statement. It says, it may not be that I can easily define obscene, but I know it when I see it. And I think it's something that typically is relatively obvious when that is the case. Now, having said that, does any of the ladies want to weigh in and to give some insight or something with regard to your thinking to give Chris some guidance in that? Or perhaps would you rather do it privately and talk to her? Anybody want to enlarge? So, you know, again, when you're saying a line, the black and white, sometimes you can do that. Sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to do so. I will say that I'm not aware of any ladies in this congregation that go overboard. But I have certainly seen ladies, Christian ladies, who in their dress definitely do go overboard. So I know it when I see it. That's all I can tell you. I know that's not very helpful. So I would suggest maybe talking to some of the older ladies about that. Which, by the way, we're going to get to in a little bit, a discussion of the teaching of the older ladies. Anybody else want to add anything to it? I was looking for women to raise their hands, not men. Jerry, you first, and then Dave.
It's been explained to me as one of the not but principles. It says not this, but this.
Right. Yeah, that's the construct.
And the one's easily understood is the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus said, not laying up treasure on earth, but laying up treasure in heaven. Now, if you take that literally, you can't have a bank account or saving money.
Yeah.
So, but that's not what it means, obviously. So that's what we're saying. You know, here is like, okay, like you said, we know it when we see it. In the Victorian age, if a woman showed her ankles, that was considered scandalous. Well, not today. That wouldn't be a standard today. So it's a bit of a nebulous thing, but I think, like you say, we know it when you see it.
Yeah. And again, there are certain things that I would say, a little bit different from what Chris's question was. I think that there are lines that we can draw with regard to what is considered modest in the sense of lewdness and lasciviousness. That's a lot of times what you see. But there are some guidelines that God has given us as to our dress in that regard. And there are guidelines that are given here as well. But you're perfectly correct with regard to this construct that is found. It's one that is typical in the Bible. It's seen often in the Greek language, where there is not an absolute, verse 9 is not, as we talked about last week, is not an absolute prohibition from wearing gold, pearls, or costly clothing. But it is a contrast to the proper approach to dress, which is that which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. And that's where we might say, not necessarily nebulous in the sense that we're not clear with regard to the directions. The directions are very clear. You need to dress like a godly woman. But then there are some differences in cultures and such, what would be the norm as to a person who is seeking to be godly and reverent and decorous in their dress. So again, ladies, talk to Chris about it. She wants some guidance and discussion with regard to it. Please do so. Dick,
in your discourse there, you left off the wearing of t-shirts with slogans and advertisements and all that.
Talked about that last week, though. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I think what Dick is referring to is with regard to men and sloppiness in worship. And by the way, the men are more likely to be sloppy than women. I think that the idea of irreverence in the sense of not being decorous in our dress, in the sense of what is proper. Men are sloppy, especially in our day and time, and so we need to be careful about that as well. Part of its influence, part of it is showing respect to God and the assembly. There's a lot that ties into it, but I think that while the application and emphasis here is women dressing in a way that is proper for a woman professing godliness, it could rightly be said that men should dress properly for a man professing godliness as well. And that's, again, that's not the central point, but it's certainly an application that we make. Yes, Dennis.
Having raised seven daughters, things come up. You know, many times the daughters come to me and say, "Dad, check me out." And that's something that's okay for fathers to do. And I would advise them, you know, what I thought. If you're a sister and you have to tell a brother, "I'm up here," you're not dressed properly. If you're dressing to emphasize certain anatomical parts of your body, you're not dressing properly. If you're dressing to be like the world, you're not dressing properly. When God said, "Come out and be separate," He means for us to be different as well. Used to be, I don't know if it is so much anymore, but you could go to Walmart, go shopping, you'd see a mother with her children in tow, and they had a certain look about them, the way they were dressed. They all had long hair, they wore long skirts, and said, "Homeschoolers." I don't know if that is true as much anymore. But that's what we're talking about. When you can look at someone and see that they're different, then that's the way you want to dress. But we don't want to do that. We don't want to be different from the world. We want to blend in. We don't want to stand out. We need to stand out. Someone needs to look at us and tell that there's something different about us. We don't dress like the world.
That's a good point. And you mentioned specifically, because I've got two daughters, and the same question's asked of me. And I think sometimes, it shouldn't be the case, but sometimes it is, that the mothers and the daughters may not be sufficiently aware of the effect that they have on men with regard to the idea of modest dress. But the men surely do. And I think that sometimes when a father should say, "No, that's not going to fly. That's not appropriate." And it may be cute. It may be desirous in some way. The young lady may want to wear it because they like the way they look in it. But it's inappropriate. And she may not even have any concept or idea as to why that would be the case. But the father surely knows. And I think that's an abdication of the father's responsibility with regard to the dressing of other daughters is a problem in the Lord's church today. And it needs to be something to be considered. Yes, Jerry?
Well, just thinking about how customs have to do with how people dress. I know when I was a kid, Sunday morning, all the women wore hats, matching and all, you know, the deal. That on Sunday evening, they didn't. Now, I never did know why the difference was, but that was just, you know, just the thing that they did. Another thing that I recall is that a woman would not leave home, go out in public without a corset on. I remember going in the walk-in closet and heard my mother's. I thought that was the worst looking thing I've ever seen in my life, all the staves and everything in it. Well, I don't know whether they even sell corsets nowadays. I don't know anybody that wear them, I suppose. But the point is, making it, when I went to work for the oil company, we had to wear a suit and a hat when we were out on the job. Went to work for the insurance company, had to wear a dark colored suit, long sleeve white shirt, and a tie. Well, why was that? Well, you know, I'd get off on Friday night, we'd go out to the mall, and my wife would go shopping, I'd just be walking around, you know. I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and ask me if I was a manager, because I had a suit on. Well, the point I'm making is, whenever styles change and people change with it, well, it's okay as long as it doesn't. Remember when the miniskirts came out?
Yeah.
You know, then we had a big deal at the office on Kohl's. And the women bolted. Man, they just said, you know, we had a problem with women because telling them how to dress. Now, tattoos, I can remember back during the war, soldiers coming to our house, and this one guy, he always had a long sleeve shirt on. I was 8 or 9 years old. I wanted to ask him, I said, it's hot, why do you always wear a long sleeve shirt? He said, well, one of my wicked moments, I got a tattoo and I'm ashamed for people to see them. Well, you walk down the street now and you see all kinds of tattoos on all kinds of people and everything. Well, now, what do you do if you see a Christian walking down the street with all of her tattoos showing? Men and women. What do you think about it? Well, you don't think bad about them as you used to, because they used to be absolutely a no-no. But at the same time, we have to say, what is modest? And I live next door to people that were Pentecostal. They didn't wear makeup. But they spent fortune on their hair, and you wouldn't see one out in public without high-heeled shoes and hose on. You know, so I'm just saying,
go to the opposite.
This is something that, you know, that a person just think, well, do you know what immodest is? And that's the whole thing. I think everybody knows what immodesty is.
Yeah, I think all of that is a function of living in the world but not being of the world. And I just want to add one thing that I did talk about last week and maybe didn't emphasize. I do want to emphasize before we go on. So you have an individual who is a Christian. And so now as a Christian, you're making decisions. What am I going to wear? What am I going to do with my body? How am I going to act? You know, we're the light of the world, city that's set on a hill. We need to be careful always in everything that we do to ensure that our influence will not be harmed. As Dennis indicated, there's a very real truth in this, that we are recognize that we're different from the world. We ought to report ourselves differently. And people should be able to tell that we're not of the world. Having said that, we have a tremendous number of people out in the world today who have done all of those things. Tattoos would be an example. Piercings an example. Those kinds of things. And so they've done that kind of thing. And now we go and we share the gospel message with them. What should our attitude be toward them? It should not be any different than our attitude would be toward an individual who's, you know, I mean, if you got a long-haired hippie with tattoos all over his body and he wants to hear the gospel, your response to him should be the same as a businessman in a suit as you're seeking to share the message of the gospel. And typically, or commonly, not typically, but commonly, there are individuals who are actually looking for the Lord, who are looking for the Lord precisely because of where they have gotten themselves in their lives, and they know and understand that they have a need for Him. And so we need to be very careful not to judge an individual as unworthy or to limit ourselves with regard to our interaction with people who don't look like we do or don't look like we think that people ought to look or don't act the way we think people ought to act, because everyone needs the gospel. And we share that gospel message with others, and it is life-altering and life-changing. And we need to recognize the importance of not allowing ourselves to be like the Pharisees were. That's the typical problem with the Pharisees. They consider themselves better than everything else. Look at us. Look at the way we are. They're not that way. And so we don't want anything to do with them. And any time a Christian begins to have that attitude, that's a Pharisaical attitude, and that's something that's completely inappropriate.
Yes, that shouldn't be our first point of attack. We're talking about the individual. Sure. We shouldn't want to correct their dress before we teach them the gospel.
Yeah.
Because once we are teaching them the gospel and they're kind of observing and looking, that's going to come up. You know, it kind of just brings to mind, you know, the Judaizing teachers. We want to correct your physical things before we want to even address what's going on in the spirit.
Good point. Yes, Steph?
This seems to be an appropriate time to bring up this, but remember, one of our boys were at camp, and at camp, you have to wear your knee, your shorts have to touch your knees.
Yeah.
And this was the last day, and I don't know if they had stopped to eat or went to the convenience store. There was a group of girls from camp that had long shorts on. They all went in and came out in very short shorts.
Changed right after camp was over. Yeah.
And I think more of the problem is what we dress like outside of worship. I know we're talking about worship now.
Well, no, I think it's more inclusive.
It comes back and forth. We are supposed to be different from the world. And one thing about coming to worship, this, we are worshiping our Lord and our God, and we should stand out and be different from the world. If I stop at the convenience store before church, they need to know I'm coming to worship and not going to, you know, stroll around at the mall or whatever.
Good point. Yeah, and there are things. We, you know, dress casual in casual situations. Just respect the Lord and never dress immodestly. And immodesty is something in the sense of what is essential, what is inappropriate to be seen in is something that is unchosen. It doesn't matter the circumstances in that regard. This issue indicated. All right, a lot of good discussion. Let's go on, and I would like to get through the remainder, or I'll try to at least, with regard to women's submission. That may not be necessary, may be possible. But this is actually the final section of our study before we get into a discussion of qualifications of overseers and deacons. And I don't want to start that today, so we'll spend the remainder of our time in verses 11 through 15. And we may not finish. We've only got 15, 20 minutes left. But if you'll read with me beginning in verse 11. So this is a continuation of the idea or the instructions that are appropriate for a woman who's professing godliness. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. So this, again, is a doctrine that I don't know that it is particularly problematic in conservative churches. It seems that the women very much are respectful of the place that they hold and not desirous of usurping that position. But having said that, there is a problem in the church with regard to this. There is looseness. I remember Tom Roberts having a written debate with an individual who was advocating women in the absence of elders taking a leadership role in a congregation. In fact, that particular individual was basically saying elders don't have authority anyway, and so it's a congregational decision that women have equal say in, that kind of thing. In the institutional churches, there's one that actually is just down the road. It used to be a theater just off of whatever, after Cherry Lane. What's the next exit? Las Vegas Trail. Just off of Las Vegas Trail, there used to be a theater that now is a church campus that's an adjunct of North Richland Hills. And they established this to be basically more progressive than their main congregation, their main group there in North Richland Hills. And this group is advocating participation of women in all aspects of worship teaching, worship leaders, those kinds of things. And it's certainly something that is problematic denominationally. And societally, the idea that women are to have a role that is submissive rather than authoritative, and that a distinction can and should be made between men and women. So let's talk a little bit about these verses. And I'll just kind of go through what I want to say, and then we'll open it up for discussion. First of all, you'll notice in verse 11, a woman is to learn in silence. The word silence here is an interesting word. It's a different word than that which was used in 1 Corinthians 14, where the Apostle Paul, in the assembly, said, "Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak." And you'll remember in that particular context, there was the use of spiritual gifts, and the women were leaving their position and place of submission by participating in those things. And Paul put a stop to it in Corinth. He said, the women are not permitted to speak. It's a different word. That word is sageo. It means absolute silence in 1 Corinthians 14. Here, the word hesousia means to be quiet or quietness. And it has reference to a demeanor. That's the specific idea or concept here, which I think is borne out in the latter part of verse 11, that she is to be submissive. Let her learn in silence with all submission. Let me give you a quick definition of that term. Thayer describes it as the life of one who stays at home doing his own work and does not officiously meddle with the affairs of others. That's the definition that Thayer gets. So he stays at home doing his own work and does not meddle in the affairs of others. He's not in everybody's face. He's not involving himself. Rather, he is taking a more silent role. Now, there are a couple of passages where this word is used in different contexts that might be helpful in this. First one is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verses 10 and 11, where the description is given that this is an admonition given not just to women here, but to brethren in general. We urge your brethren, you increase more and more, that you aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you. That quiet life under consideration is this word. So it's not specifically having reference to the idea of not speaking at all, as 1 Corinthians 14 is, but rather this idea of a quietness. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 is the other passage where there were some who were being busybodies. You remember they had stopped working and instead were waiting for the Lord's coming. And so because idle hands were the devil's workshop, they were involving themselves in such idleness. And in verse 12 of 2 Thessalonians 3, Paul said, we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. And those who are such, we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. So the word quietness is the same word there as well. And so what this is a prohibition against women occupying that role of authority. And the phrase with all submission bears this out. So she's to be a retiring person, not a person who's wanting to be in charge and out in front. That's the concept that's found in the particular text. So it has reference, just as the dress does, to the proper demeanor that a woman is to have. And this idea of usurping authority is what's under consideration in the text. You'll notice in verse 12, he said, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. So looking at that, that idea of teaching or having authority over a man, we recognize, again, in our congregation, and typically this is understood and recognized in faithful congregations. The men are the ones who take the position of authority in teaching and preaching and leadership. We do want to note that this is not an absolute prohibition against teaching, because in other passages, women are told to teach. The one that specifically comes to mind that I mentioned that we would allude to it as we were discussing Chris's question is found in Titus chapter 2 and verses 3 and 5. But I want you to notice when the teaching is done by a woman that there is a specific group that she is to teach concerning specific subjects and for specific purposes. And notice in verses 3 and 5, the older women are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. And so, it's an obvious violation when some will claim, and this is an argument I heard just recently in the institutional church, is made by a man who was lecturing at ACU, saying that we're not using one of our greatest resources, we're not using our women. And he advocated that it was all right for a woman to teach as long as she did not usurp authority. So the idea was that as long as she was not argumentative, as long as she was not dictatorial with regard to her language, dominant or seeking to dominate, as she taught, that it would be acceptable for her to teach a man. What's not being acknowledged is that in this particular passage, and in the position of a teacher or a preacher, that authority is inherent in that position. As a teacher of this class, I have inherently some authority in that position as a teacher. And as a result of that, women are not to be elevated to a position where they exercise said authority over men. And that's what's being precluded in this particular passage. Now, one other point, then we'll open it up to any discussion. In verses 13 and 14, he says, Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. These are the arguments that the Apostle Paul makes to say why this is the case. You'll notice the word for there. It's the Greek word gar. And Thayer says that gar is used in this context as adducing the cause or giving the reason why the preceding statement or opinion is so. So women are not to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to learn in silence because or for Adam was formed first than Eve. So it is based not in culture. And that's, of course, the typical argument that will be made today by those who would advocate for women having an authoritative role in the worship, is that Paul was a product of his time. And though it would have been inappropriate for women in that culture to have these positions, now things have changed. Our culture is different. As a result of that, women now can teach. I want you to notice the Apostle Paul is not arguing from culture in this particular text. He's arguing from creation. It was the place and it was the purpose for which these individuals were created, Adam and Eve. Eve created as a helper suitable to the man. Secondly, with regard to the circumstances of the fall when they sinned, you'll notice the statement that Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. That's the difficult one. So, are women held in this particular position because of one woman's sin and the way in which her sin took place? And there are a couple of comments that I came across when I was studying this that I thought interesting. Marshall Patton wrote the commentary for the Truth series, Truth Magazine series, or the Guardian Truth Foundation series, on this particular book. And I want you to notice that something he said, basically I'll just paraphrase to you. Patton says that this intimates that stereotypically, and he's talking broad tones, that a woman is more vulnerable to deception than the man. I think that's arguable, and I wanted to kind of bring that up as to what y'all thought about that. And he's not saying that all women are more easily deceived than men, or that a particular woman is more easily deceived than a man, because we recognize that men can be very foolish as well. But he's talking about these kinds of aspects of how individuals are made. God made men and women different. And it's something that we embrace. Typically, with regard to man, for example, we'll talk about how men are more prone to violence than women. Pretty much everybody recognizes that. In women's movement today, the idea is that men are the problem with the world, and if women were in charge, things would be a lot better. So women will acknowledge that men have a tendency to be more violent. I would acknowledge that as well. With regard to the problem of lust, men have a greater problem with that than women. That's not to say that women cannot have a problem with lust, because they certainly can. Stereotypically, we're talking in these big ranges. So Patton is saying, is there a possibility, or that he thinks that it is so, that women can be more vulnerable to deception than men? I thought that's an interesting thing that was worthy at least of some discussion. I remember that when I brought an issue up between men and women, talking about the woman being the weaker vessel years and years and years ago, how it was that the men said, oh, no, no, all that means is physically not as strong. And the women said, no, 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 no. It had something to do with the tenderness of the woman, how God made her, and those kinds of things. And the men weren't willing to do that because they had been culturally conditioned not to say that women are in any way, quote, inferior, but the women recognize the difference between men and women. So is this another example of it? Yes, Josh.
That's not inferior at all.
No, no, it's not. But again, that's the way it's presented culturally. And and we need to recognize there is a difference. But the question at this point is, with the concept of deception, is this merely punitive, saying that the reason a woman has a place in... There are two reasons given, and equally legitimate. So the woman would still be in a position of submission even if this second argument wasn't made, because God created Adam first. But this is given as a reason. So what is intended by this reason? That the woman was deceived, not the man.
Just in teaching the high school class years ago, this topic came up, and we pretty much had young ladies and young men and having to teach this to them. And I just used the illustration. I said, you know, the things, I said, we all understand that men and women are different. And of course, all these teenagers, yeah, they got that. And the things that make a woman more suitable to be a mother than a man, the illustration I used is the baby's sitting there crying, the man's sitting there going, okay, well, the baby's fed, the baby's dry, and, you know, all these things, we're going on the checklist and trying to figure out why the baby's crying. In the meantime, mom's already taking care of things because she knows the baby just wants to be held and loved. Well, you know, we're trying to be kind of academic about it, and I said, you know, men are not designed to be mothers, and women are not designed to be fathers, and God gave us each in our own roles to fill our own roles, and we complement each other. And, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
I said, I didn't design this. Had no responsibility there. However, we do carry those things out. Of course, now our society is having a problem with it.
Sure.
We can't figure out who we are and what we are. And yet, what's the very first thing when a baby is born? What do we ask? How tall they are? How much do they weigh? No, we ask more girl. And I've not heard anyone reply yet, well, I'm not sure, we haven't asked them yet.
Yeah. Well, actually, there are those who are advocating that, though. There are individuals who are saying that gender should not be assigned until the child makes the decision for themselves, which is absurd. But that's where our society is going. Yes, Chuck?
My thoughts on this are the women that cry out for equality, as it's so called in our society today, don't really understand what they're asking any more than the children of Israel, when they started calling for a king, fully understood what they were asking for, and then they eventually got everything God told them they were going to get because of what they were asking for. You see, watch the news, you see all these political riots going on, and these women marching with men that go attack some person that disagrees with them politically, and that person, in their self-defense, strikes out, and then somewhere in there, a woman gets hit. He hit a woman. Well, yes, because you were attacking me and you kind of want equality. Well, if you're attacking me, my fist is for everybody who's attacking me. Well, he hit a woman. Okay, equality. Well, there's that. That's the world. But women inside the church, I think, who want this equality do not understand what they're asking for. Because when it comes down to things, as a husband, as a father, as a Lord willing future leader in the congregation, I have to answer for all of those things. Not my wife, not my children. Now, they have to answer for their own things, but I have to answer for the things that I teach in my household. Not my wife. I have to answer for what goes on in my household, not my wife. When it comes to the Lord's church, should I attain the office of elder one day, which is one of my desires, the elder is responsible for what goes on in his congregation. And the Lord says, we're going to get judged accordingly. Teachers will get a stricter judgment. Elders will be scrutinized for all those things. And they just don't understand.
Well, I think that's a general problem societally, is the concept of the burden of authority. Individuals want the authority because of the power and the benefits of it. and men and women. And the burden of authority is something that's not commonly accepted even or desired. One point to be made, I do want us to recognize that the patriarchal hierarchy that is established in Scripture has been much abused in the world, and it has been much abused even among God's people in the past, that women are taken advantage of because of their position of vulnerability. And so the existence societally where individuals are not governed by or interested in what the Bible has to say, there's some it's somewhat understandable with regard to women's movement because women have been mistreated. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, because societies in general in the past have been patriarchal in their nature. Secondly, because of the relatively less physically strong and capable that the woman is, so that the man can dominate. We see that all the time with regard to domestic abuse and sexual crime. And so the call for women to be treated well and women to be treated equally is something that is understandable in our society. What society has departed from is this concept that, yes, women are to be treated well, and a proper understanding of the biblical roles exalts both the man and the woman and is beneficial to both the man and the woman. And that's what's been rejected, and that's what's problematic in our day. But it's something that we as Christians have to recognize and we have to acknowledge as being the case. We're almost out of time. Looking at what we have discussed here, there are a couple of things that we need to add to it. And first of all, we'll open it up for any discussion next week if anyone wants to add to this idea of the two reasons. But I do want to talk a little bit more about culture, because we do have it on the next slide. The next slide is culture. Has anything to do with it? My answer already was no, but I do want to address it a little bit. And then, what is meant in verse 15? She will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. What in the world does childbearing have to do with salvation? Because a cursory reading of that can be somewhat confusing, and we want to explain what is intended by that. After having done that, then we'll get into the third chapter, and I would like to encourage you to read verses 1 through 13 and to be kind of familiarizing yourself with the qualifications themselves. We'll start tomorrow next week by talking a little bit about the office of a bishop and the approach that we need to take with regard to a discussion of these qualifications, both with bishops and deacons. We'll want to get into a discussion that could potentially or can potentially be somewhat contentious. Churches have divided over what does this particular qualification mean. So I'd like you to be familiar with it. We'll have, a reasoned approach as how to deal with this particular thing. It's very important that we define and determine what are the qualifications of overseers as well as deacons. All right? So we'll pick up that next week. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today and the discussion as well.